she said.
Then I'll go alone, Paul said.
Sir, if you...
Arthheim wants it this way, Paul said, barely concealing the irony which consumed him.
Sire, it's too dangerous, Banerjee protested.
Even an emperor must accept some risks, Paul said. The decision is made. Do as I've commanded. Reluctantly, Banerjee led the face dancer from the room. Paul turned toward the blank screen behind his desk. He felt that he waited for the arrival of a rock on its blind journey from some height. Should he tell Banerjee about the messenger's true nature, he wondered. No. Such an incident hadn't been written on the screen of his vision. Any deviation here carried precipitate violence. A moment of fulcrum had to be found, a place where he could will himself out of the vision. If such a moment existed. No matter how exotic human civilization becomes, no matter the developments of life and society, nor the complexity of the machine-human interface, there always come interludes of lonely power when the course of humankind, the very future of humankind, depends upon the relatively simple actions of single individuals. From the Tlelaxu Godbook. As he crossed over on the high footbridge from his keep to the Kizerat office building, Paul added a limp to his walk. It was almost sunset, and he walked through long shadows that helped conceal him, but sharp eyes still might detect something in his carriage that identified him. He wore a shield, but it was not activated, his aides having decided that the shimmer of it might arouse suspicions. Paul glanced left. Strings of sand clouds lay across the sunset like slatted shutters. The air was hearig dry through his still-suit filters. He wasn't really alone out here, but the web of security hadn't been this loose around him since he'd ceased walking the streets alone in the night. Ornithopters with night scanners drifted far overhead in seemingly random pattern, all of them tied to his movements through a transmitter concealed in his clothing. Picked men walked the streets below. Others had fanned out through the city after seeing the Emperor in his disguise, Fremen costume down to the stillsuit and Temag desert boots, the darkened features. His cheeks had been distorted with plastine inserts. A catch tube ran down along his left jaw. As he reached the opposite end of the bridge, Paul glanced back, noted a movement beside the stone lattice that concealed a balcony of his private quarters. Cheney, no doubt. Hunting for sand in the desert, she called this venture. How little she understood the bitter choice. Selecting among agonies, he thought, made even lesser agonies near unbearable. For a blurred, emotionally painful moment, he relived their parting. At the last instant, Cheney had experienced a dull glimpse of his feelings, but she had misinterpreted. She had thought his emotions were those experienced in the parting of loved ones when one entered the dangerous unknown. Would that I did not know, he thought. He had crossed the bridge now and entered the upper passageway through the office building. There were fixed glow globes here and people hurrying on business. The Kizerat never slept. Paul found his attention caught by the signs above doorways, as though he were seeing them for the first time. Speed merchants, wind stills and retorts, prophetic prospects, tests of faith, religious supply, weaponry. Propagation of the faith. A more honest label would have been propagation of the bureaucracy, he thought. A type of religious civil servant had sprung up all through his universe. This new man of the Kizerat was more often a convert. He seldom displaced a Fremen in the key posts, but he was filling all the interstices. He used Melange as much to show he could afford it as for the geriatric benefits. He stood apart from his rulers. Emperor, guild, Bene Gesserit, Lanthrat, family, or Kizerate. His gods were routine and records. He was served by mentats and prodigious filing systems. Expediency was the first word in his catechism, although he gave proper lip service to the precepts of the Butlerians. Machines could not be fashioned in the image of a man's mind, he said, but he betrayed by every action that he preferred machines to men, statistics to individuals. The faraway general view to the intimate personal touch requiring imagination and initiative. As Paul emerged onto the ramp at the far side of the building, he heard the bells calling the evening rite at Alia's fane. There was an odd feeling of permanence about the bells. The temple across the thronged square was new, its rituals of recent devising, but there was something about this setting in a desert sink at the edge of Arakeen, something in the way wind-driven sand had begun to weather stones and plastine, something in the haphazard way buildings had gone up around the fane. Everything conspired to produce the impression that this was a very old place, full of traditions and mystery. He was down into the press of people now. Committed. The only guide his security force could find had insisted it be done this way. Security hadn't liked Paul's ready agreement. Stilgar had liked it even less, and Chaney had objected most of all. The crowd around him, even while its members brushed against him, glanced his way unseeing and passed on, gave him a curious freedom of movement. It was the way they'd been conditioned to treat a Fremen, he knew. He carried himself like a man of the inner desert. Such men were quick to anger. As he moved into the quickening flow to the temple steps, the crush of people became even greater. Those all around could not help but press against him now, but he found himself the target for ritual apologies.
"Your pardon, noble sir, I cannot prevent this discourtesy."
"Pardon, sir, this crush of people is the worst I've ever seen. I abase myself, holy citizen, a lout shoved me."
Paul ignored the words after the first few. There was no feeling in them except a kind of ritual fear. He found himself, instead, thinking that he had come a long way from his boyhood days in Caladan Castle. Where had he put his foot on the path that led to this journey across a crowded square on a planet so far from Caladan? Had he really put his foot on a path? He could not say he had acted at any point in his life for one specific reason. The motives and impinging forces had been complex, more complex possibly than any other set of goads in human history. He had the heady feeling here that he might still avoid the fate he could see so clearly along this path. But the crowd pushed him forward, and he experienced the dizzy sense that he had lost his way, lost personal direction over his life. The crowd flowed with him up the steps now into the temple portico. Voices grew hushed, the smell of fear grew stronger, acrid, sweaty. Acolytes had already begun the service within the temple. Their plain chant dominated the other sounds, whispers, rustle of garments, shuffling feet, coughs, telling the story of the far places visited by the priestess in her holy trance. "She rides the sandworm of space. She guides through all storms into the land of gentle winds. Though we sleep by the snake's den, she guards our dreaming souls. Shunning the desert heat, she hides us in a cool hollow. The gleaming of her white teeth guides us in the night. By the braids of her hair, we are lifted up to heaven. Sweet fragrance, flower-scented, surrounds us in her presence."
"Belach," Paul thought, thinking in Fremen. "Look out, she can be filled with angry passion too."
The temple portico was lined with tall, slender glow tubes simulating candle flame. They flickered. The flickering stirred ancestral memories in Paul, even while he knew that was the intent. This setting was an atavism, subtly contrived, effective. He hated his own hand in it. The crowd flowed with him through tall metal doors into the gigantic nave, a gloomy place with the flickering lights far away overhead, a brilliantly illuminated altar at the far end. Behind the altar, a deceptively simple affair of black wood encrusted with sand patterns from the Fremen mythology, hidden lights played on the field of a prue door to create a rainbow borealis. The seven rows of chanting acolytes ranked below that spectral curtain took on an eerie quality, black robes, white faces, mouths moving in unison. Paul studied the pilgrims around him, suddenly envious of their intentness, their air of listening to truths he could not hear. It seemed to him that they gained something here which was denied to him, something mysteriously healing. He tried to inch his way closer to the altar, was stopped by a hand on his arm. Paul whipped his gaze around, met the probing stare of an ancient Fremen, blue, blue eyes beneath overhanging brows, recognition in them. A name flashed into Paul's mind. Rasir, a companion from the Sietch days. In the press of the crowd, Paul knew he was completely vulnerable if Rasir planned violence. The old man pressed close, one hand beneath a sand-grimed robe, grasping the hilt of a kris knife, no doubt. Paul set himself as best he could to resist attack. The old man moved his head toward Paul's ear, whispered,
"We will go with the others."
It was the signal to identify his guide. Paul nodded. Rasir drew back, faced the altar. "She comes from the east," the acolytes chanted. "The sun stands at her back. All things are exposed. In the full glare of light, her eyes miss no thing, neither light nor dark." A wailing rebaba jarred across the voices, stilled them, receded into silence. With an electric abruptness, the crowd surged forward several meters. They were packed into a tight mass of flesh now, the air heavy with their breathing and the scent of spice. "Shai Hulud writes on clean sand," the acolytes shouted. Paul felt his own breath catch in unison with those around him. A feminine chorus began singing faintly from the shadows behind the shimmering Prue door. "Aliyah, Aliyah, Aliyah." It grew louder and louder, fell to a sudden silence. Again, voices beginning vesper soft. "She stills all storms, her eyes kill our enemies and torment the unbelievers. From the spires of Tuono, where dawnlight strikes and clear water runs, you see her shadow. In the shining summer heat, she serves us bread and milk. Cool, fragrant with spices, her eyes melt our enemies, torment our oppressors, and pierce all mysteries. She is Aliyah. Aliyah, Aliyah." Slowly the voices trailed off. Paul felt sickened. "What are we doing?" he asked himself. Aliyah was a child witch, but she was growing older, and he thought, growing older is to grow more wicked. The collective mental atmosphere of the temple ate at his psyche. He could sense that element of himself which was one with those all around him, but the differences formed a deadly contradiction. He stood immersed, isolated in a personal sin which he could never expiate. The immensity of the universe outside the temple flooded his awareness. How could one man, one ritual, hope to knit such immensity into a garment fitted to all men? Paul shuddered. The universe opposed him at every step. It eluded his grasp, conceived countless disguises to delude him. That universe would never agree with any shape he gave it. A profound hush spread through the temple. Aliyah emerged from the darkness behind the shimmering rainbows. She wore a yellow robe trimmed in Atreides green, yellow for sunlight, green for the death which produced life. Paul experienced the sudden, surprising thought that Aliyah had emerged here just for him. For him alone. He stared across the mob in the temple at his sister. She was his sister. He knew her ritual and its roots, but he had never before stood out here with the pilgrims, watched her through their eyes. Here, performing the mystery of this place, he saw that she partook of the universe which opposed him. Acolytes brought her a golden chalice. Aliyah raised the chalice. With part of his awareness, Paul knew that the chalice contained the unaltered melange, the subtle poison, her sacrament of the oracle. Her gaze on the chalice, Aliyah spoke. Her voice caressed the ears, flower sound, flowing and musical. "In the beginning, we were empty," she said. "Ignorant of all things," the chorus sang. "We did not know the power that abides in every place," Aliyah said. "And in every time," the chorus sang. "Here is the power," Aliyah said, raising the chalice slightly. "It brings us joy," sang the chorus. "And it brings us distress," Paul thought. "It awakens the soul," Aliyah said. "It dispels all doubts," the chorus sang. "In worlds we perish," Aliyah said. "In the power we survive," sang the chorus. Aliyah put the chalice to her lips, drank. To his astonishment, Paul found he was holding his breath like the meanest pilgrim of this mob. Despite every shred of personal knowledge about the experience Alia was undergoing, he had been caught in the Tao web. He felt himself remembering how that fiery poison coursed into the body. Memory unfolded the time-stopping when awareness became a mote which changed the poison. He re-experienced the awakening into timelessness where all things were possible. He knew Alia's present experience, yet he saw now that he did not know it. Mystery blinded the eyes. Alia trembled, sank to her knees. Paul exhaled with the enraptured pilgrims. He nodded. Part of the veil began to lift from him. Absorbed in the bliss of a vision, he had forgotten that each vision belonged to all those who were still on the way, still to become. In the vision, one passed through a darkness, unable to distinguish reality from insubstantial accident. One hungered for absolutes which could never be. Hungering, one lost the present. Alia swayed with a rapture of spice change. Paul felt that some transcendental presence spoke to him, saying, "Look, see there, see what you've ignored." In that instant, he thought he looked through other eyes, that he saw an imagery and rhythm in this place which no artist or poet could reproduce. It was vital and beautiful, a glaring light that exposed all power gluttony, even his own. Alia spoke. Her amplified voice boomed across the nave.
"Luminous night!" she cried.
A moan swept like a wave through the crush of pilgrims.
"Nothing hides in such a night," Alia said. "What rare light is this darkness? You cannot fix your gaze upon it. Senses cannot record it. No words describe it."
Her voice lowered.
"The abyss remains. It is pregnant with all the things yet to be. Ah, what gentle violence!"
Paul felt that he waited for some private signal from his sister. It could be any action or word, something of wizardry and mystical processes, an outward streaming that would fit him like an arrow into a cosmic bow. This instant lay like quivering mercury in his awareness.
"There will be sadness," Alia intoned. "I remind you that all things are but a beginning, forever beginning. Worlds wait to be conquered. Some within the sound of my voice will attain exalted destinies. You will sneer at the past, forgetting what I tell you now. Within all differences there is unity."
Paul suppressed a cry of disappointment as Alia lowered her head. She had not said the thing he waited to hear. His body felt like a dry shell, a husk abandoned by some desert insect. Others must feel something similar, he thought. He sensed the restlessness about him. Abruptly, a woman in the mob, someone far down in the nave to Paul's left, cried out, a wordless noise of anguish. Alia lifted her head, and Paul had the giddy sensation that the distance between them collapsed, that he stared directly into her glazed eyes only inches away from her.
"Who summons me?" Alia asked.
"I do,"
the woman cried.
"I do, Alia. Oh, Alia, help me. They say my son was killed on Muritan. Is he gone? Will I never see my son again? Never!"
"You try to walk backward in the sand," Alia intoned. "Nothing is lost. Everything returns later. But you may not recognize the changed form that returns."
"Alia, I don't understand,"
the woman wailed. "You live in the air, but you do not see it," Alia said, sharpness in her voice. "Are you a lizard? Your voice has a Fremen accent. Does a Fremen try to bring back the dead? What do we need from our dead except their water?"
Down in the center of the nave, a man in a rich red cloak lifted both hands, the sleeves falling to expose white-clad arms.
"Alia," he shouted, "I have had a business proposal. Should I accept?"
"You come here like a beggar," Alia said. "You look for the golden bowl, but you will find only a dagger."
"I have been asked to kill a man,"
a voice shouted from off to the right, a deep voice with Sietch tones.
Should I accept? Accepting, would I succeed?
Beginning and end are a single thing, Alia snapped. Have I not told you this before? You didn't come here to ask that question. What is it you cannot believe that you must come here and cry out against it?
She's in a fierce mood tonight,
a woman near Paul muttered. Have you ever seen her this angry?
She knows I'm out here, Paul thought. Did she see something in the vision that angered her? Is she raging at me?
Alia!
A man directly in front of Paul called.
Tell these businessmen and faint hearts how long your brother will rule!
I permit you to look around that corner by yourself, Alia snarled. You carry your prejudice in your mouth. It is because my brother rides the Worm of Chaos that you have roof and water.
With a fierce gesture, clutching her robe, Alia whirled away, strode through the shimmering ribbons of light, was lost in the darkness behind. Immediately the acolytes took up the closing chant, but their rhythm was off. Obviously they'd been caught by the unexpected ending of the rite. An incoherent mumbling arose on all sides of the crowd. Paul felt the stirring around him, restless, dissatisfied.
It was that fool with his stupid question about business, a woman near Paul muttered. The hypocrite!
What had Alia seen? What track through the future? Something had happened here tonight, souring the right of the oracle. Usually the crowd clamoured for Alia to answer their pitiful questions. They came as beggars to the oracle, yes. He had heard them thus many times as he'd watched, hidden in the darkness behind the altar. What had been different about this night? The old Fremen tugged Paul's sleeve, nodded toward the exit. The crowd already was beginning to push in that direction. Paul allowed himself to be pressed along with them, the guide's hand upon his sleeve. There was the feeling in him then that his body had become the manifestation of some power he could no longer control. He had become a non-being, a stillness which moved itself. At the core of the non-being, there he existed, allowing himself to be led through the streets of his city, following a track so familiar to his visions that it froze his heart with grief.
I should know what Alia saw, he thought. I have seen it enough times myself. And she didn't cry out against it. She saw the alternatives, too.
Production growth and income growth must not get out of step in my empire. That is the substance of my command. There are to be no balance of payment difficulties between the different spheres of influence, and the reason for this is simply because I command it. I want to emphasize my authority in this area. I am the supreme energy eater of this domain and will remain so, alive or dead. My government is the economy. Order in Council. The Emperor Paul Muad'Dib.
I will leave you here,
the old man said, taking his hand from Paul's sleeve.
It is on the right, second door from the far end. Go with Shai Hulud, Muad'Dib, and remember when you were Usul.
Paul's guide slipped away into the darkness. There would be security men somewhere out there, waiting to grab the guide and take the man to a place of questioning, Paul knew. But Paul found himself hoping the old Fremen would escape. There were stars overhead, and the distant light of the first moon somewhere beyond the shield wall. But this place was not the open desert where a man could sight on a star to guide his course. The old man had brought him into one of the new suburbs. This much Paul recognized. This street now was thick with sand blown in from encroaching dunes. A dim light glowed from a single public suspensor globe far down the street. It gave enough illumination to show that this was a dead-end street. The air around him was thick with the smell of a reclamation still. The thing must be poorly capped for its fetid odors to escape, loosing a dangerously wasteful amount of moisture into the night air. How careless his people had grown, Paul thought. They were millionaires of water, forgetful of the days when a man on Arrakis could have been killed for just an eighth share of the water in his body.
Why am I hesitating? Paul wondered. It is the second door from the far end. I knew that without being told.
But this thing must be played out with precision, so I hesitate. The noise of an argument arose suddenly from the corner house on Paul's left. A woman there berated someone. The new wing of their house leaked dust, she complained. Did he think water fell from heaven? If dust came in, moisture got out.
Some remember, Paul thought.
He moved down the street and the quarrel faded away behind.
Water from heaven, he thought.
Some Fremen had seen that wonder on other worlds. He had seen it himself, had ordered it for Arrakis, but the memory of it felt like something that had occurred to another person. Rain, it was called. Abruptly, he recalled a rainstorm on his birth world, clouds thick and grey in the sky of Caladan, an electric storm presence, moist air, the big wet drops drumming on skylights. It ran in rivulets off the eaves. Storm drains took the water away to a river which ran muddy and turgid past the family orchards, trees there with their barren branches glistening wetly. Paul's foot caught in a low drift of sand across the street. For an instant he felt mud clinging to the shoes of his childhood. Then he was back in the sand, in the dust-clotted, wind-muffled darkness with the future hanging over him, taunting. He could feel the aridity of life around him like an accusation.
You did this.
They'd become a civilization of dry-eyed watchers and tale-tellers, people who solved all problems with power and more power. And still more power, hating every erg of it. Rough stones came underfoot. His vision remembered them. The dark rectangle of a doorway appeared on his right, black in black. Othheim's house. Fate's house. A place different from the ones around it only in the role time had chosen for it. It was a strange place to be marked down in history. The door opened to his knock. The gap revealed the dull green light of an atrium. A dwarf peered out, ancient face on a child's body. An apparition prescience had never seen.
You've come, then, the apparition said.
The dwarf stepped aside, no awe in his manner, merely the gloating of a slow smile.
Come in, come in.
Paul hesitated. There'd been no dwarf in the vision, but all else remained identical. Visions could contain such disparities, and still hold true to their original plunge into infinity. But the difference dared him to hope. He glanced back up the street at the creamy pearl glistening of his moon swimming out of jagged shadows. The moon haunted him. How did it fall?
Come in, the dwarf insisted.
Paul entered, heard the door thud into its moisture seals behind. The dwarf passed him, led the way, enormous feet slapping the floor, opened the delicate lattice gate into the roofed central courtyard, gestured.
They await, sire.
Sire, Paul thought. He knows me, then. Before Paul could explore this discovery, the dwarf slipped away down a side passage. Hope was a dervish wind whirling, dancing in Paul. He headed across the courtyard. It was a dark and gloomy place, the smell of sickness and defeat in it. He felt daunted by the atmosphere. Was it defeat to choose a lesser evil, he wondered. How far down this track had he come? Light poured from a narrow doorway in the far wall. He put down the feeling of watchers and evil smells, entered the doorway into a small room. It was a barren place by Fremen standards, with Hyrig hangings on only two walls. Opposite the door, a man sat on carmine cushions beneath the best hanging. A feminine figure hovered in shadows behind another doorway in a barren wall to the left. Paul felt vision trapped. This was the way it had gone. Where was the dwarf? Where was the difference? His senses absorbed the room in a single gestalten sweep. The place had received painstaking care despite its poor furnishings. Hooks and rods across the barren walls showed where hangings had been removed. Pilgrims paid enormous prices for authentic Fremen artifacts, Paul reminded himself. Rich pilgrims counted desert tapestries as treasures, true marks of a Hajj. Paul felt that the barren walls accused him with their fresh gypsum wash. The threadbare condition of the two remaining hangings amplified the sense of guilt. A narrow shelf occupied the wall on his right. It held a row of portraits, mostly bearded Fremen, some in stillsuits with their catch tubes dangling, some in imperial uniforms posed against exotic off-world backgrounds. The most common scene was a seascape. The Fremen on cushions cleared his throat, forcing Paul to look at him. It was Othheim precisely as the vision had revealed him. Neck grown scrawny, a bird thing which appeared too weak to support the large head. The face was a lopsided ruin, networks of criss-crossed scars on the left cheek below a drooping wet eye, but clear skin on the other side and a straight blue-in-blue Fremen gaze. A long kedge of a nose bisected the face. Othheim's cushion sat in the centre of a threadbare rug, brown with maroon and gold threads. The cushion fabric betrayed splotches of wear and patching, but every bit of metal around the seated figure shone from polishing, the portrait frames, shelf lip and brackets, the pedestal of a low table on the right. Paul nodded to the clear half of Othheim's face, said, "Good luck to you and your dwelling place." It was the greeting of an old friend and Sietch mate.
"So I see you once more, Ussul."
The voice speaking his tribal name whined with an old man's quavering. The dull, drooping eye on the ruined side of the face moved above the parchment skin and scars. Grey bristles stubbled that side, and the jawline there hung with scabrous peelings. Othheim's mouth twisted as he spoke, the gap exposing silvery metal teeth.
"Muad'Dib always answers the call of a Fadaikin," Paul said.
The woman in the doorway shadows moved. Said,
"So Stilgar boasts?"
She came forward into the light, an older version of the Lichner which the face dancer had copied. Paul recalled then that Othheim had married sisters. Her hair was grey, nose grown witch sharp. Weaver's calluses ran along her forefingers and thumbs. A Fremen woman would have displayed such marks proudly in the Sietch days, but she saw his attention on her hands, hid them under a fold of her pale blue robe. Paul remembered her name then, Duri. The shock was he remembered her as a child, not as she'd been in his vision of these moments. It was the whine that edged her voice, Paul told himself. She'd whined even as a child.
"You see me here," Paul said. "Would I be here if Stilgar hadn't approved?"
He turned toward Othheim.
"I carry your water burden, Othheim. Command me."
This was the straight Fremen talk of Sietch brothers. Othheim produced a shaky nod, almost too much for that thin neck. He lifted a liver-marked left hand, pointed to the ruin of his face.
"I caught the splitting disease on Tarahel, Ussul,"
he wheezed.
"Right after the victory, when we'd all..."
A fit of coughing stopped his voice.
"The tribe will collect his water soon," Duri said.
She crossed to Othheim, propped pillows behind him, held his shoulder to steady him until the coughing passed. She wasn't really very old, Paul saw, but a look of lost hopes ringed her mouth, bitterness lay in her eyes.
"I'll summon doctors," Paul said.
Duri turned, hand on hip.
"We've had medical men, as good as any you could summon."
She sent an involuntary glance to the barren wall on her left.
And the medical men were costly, Paul thought.
He felt edgy, constrained by the vision but aware that minor differences had crept in. How could he exploit the differences? Time came out of its skein with subtle changes, but the background fabric held oppressive sameness. He knew with terrifying certainty that if he tried to break out of the enclosing pattern here, it had become a thing of terrible violence. The power in this deceptively gentle flow of time oppressed him.
"Say what you want of me," he growled.
"Couldn't it be that Othheim needed a friend to stand by him in this time?" Duri asked. "Does a Fadaikin have to consign his flesh to strangers?"
"We shared Sietch Tabor," Paul reminded himself. "She has the right to berate me for apparent callousness." "What I can do, I will do," Paul said.
Another fit of coughing shook Othheim. When it had passed, he gasped,
"There's treachery, Usul. Fremen plot against you."
His mouth worked then without sound. Spittle escaped his lips. Duri wiped his mouth with a corner of her robe, and Paul saw how her face betrayed anger at such waste of moisture. Frustrated rage threatened to overwhelm Paul then.
"The Rothheim should be spent thus. Avadaikin deserves better."
But no choice remained, not for a death commando or his emperor. They walked Occam's razor in this room. The slightest misstep multiplied horrors, not just for themselves, but for all humankind, even for those who would destroy them. Paul squeezed calmness into his mind, looked at Duri. The expression of terrible longing with which she gazed at Othheim strengthened Paul.
"Janie must never look at me that way," he told himself.
"Lichnar spoke of a message," Paul said.
"My dwarf,"
Othheim wheezed.
"I bought him on a world. I forget. He's a human distrance, a toy discarded by the Tlelaxu. He's recorded all the names, the traitors."
Othheim fell silent, trembling.
"You speak of Lichnar," Duri said. "When you arrived, we knew she'd reached you safely. If you're thinking of this new burden Othheim places upon you, Lichnar is the sum of that burden. An even exchange, Usul. Take the dwarf and go."
Paul suppressed a shudder, closed his eyes.
Lichnar.
The real daughter had perished in the desert, a Samuta-racked body abandoned to the sand and the wind. Opening his eyes, Paul said,
"You could have come to me at any time, for
Othheim stayed away that he might be numbered among those who hate you, Usul," Duri said. "The house to the south of us at the end of the street, that is the gathering place for your foes. It's why we took this hovel."
"Then summon the dwarf and we'll leave," Paul said.
"You've not listened well," Duri said.
"You must take the dwarf to a safe place,"
Othheim said, an odd strength in his voice.
"He carries the only record of the traitors. No one suspects his talent. They think I keep him for amusement."
"We cannot leave," Duri said.
"Only you and the dwarf. It's known how poor we are. We've said we're selling the dwarf. They'll take you for the buyer. It's your only chance."
Paul consulted his memory of the vision. In it, he'd left here with the names of the traitors, but never seeing how those names were carried. The dwarf obviously moved under the protection of another oracle. It occurred to Paul then that all creatures must carry some kind of destiny, stamped out by purposes of varying strengths, by the fixation of training and disposition. From the moment the jihad had chosen him, he'd felt himself hemmed in by the forces of a multitude. Their fixed purposes demanded and controlled his course. Any delusions of free will he harbored now must be merely the prisoner rattling his cage. His curse lay in the fact that he saw the cage.
He saw it.
He listened now to the emptiness of this house. Only the four of them in it. Duri, Othheim, the dwarf, and himself. He inhaled the fear and tension of his companions, sensed the watchers, his own force hovering in thopters far overhead, and those others. Next door.
I was wrong to hope, Paul thought.
But thinking of hope brought him a twisted sense of hope, and he felt that he might yet seize his moment.
"Summon the dwarf," he said.
"Bijaz,"
Duri called.
"You called me."
The dwarf stepped into the room from the courtyard, an alert expression of worry on his face.
"You have a new master, Bijaz,"
Duri said. She stared at Paul.
"You may call him Usul."
"Usul, that's the base of the pillar,"
Bijaz said, translating.
"How can Usul be base when I'm the basest thing living?"
"He always speaks thus,"
Othheim apologized.
"I don't speak,"
Bijaz said,
I operate a machine called Language. It creaks and groans, but is mine own.
At Lelaxu Toy, learned and alert, Paul thought. The Bennett Lelax never threw away something this valuable. He turned, studied the dwarf. Round, melange eyes returned his stare.
What other talents have you, Bijaz? Paul asked. I know when we should leave, Bijaz said. It's a talent few men have. There's a time for endings, and that's a good beginning. Let us begin to go, Usul.
Paul examined his vision memory. No dwarf, but the little man's words fitted the occasion.
At the door you called me sire, Paul said. You know me then?
You've sired, sire, Bijaz said, grinning. You are much more than the base, Usul. You're the Atreides Emperor, Paul Muad'Dib, and you are my finger.
He held out the index finger of his right hand.
Bijaz! Duri snapped. You tempt fate!
I tempt my finger,
Bijaz protested, voice squeaking. He pointed at Usul.
I point at Usul. Is my finger not Usul himself, or is it a reflection of something more base?
He brought the finger close to his eyes, examined it with a mocking grin, first one side, then the other.
Ah, it's merely a finger, after all.
He often rattles on thus, Duri said, worry in her voice. I think it's why he was discarded by the Tlelaxu.
I'll not be patronized, Bijaz said, yet I have a new patron. How strange the workings of the finger.
He peered at Duri and Orthheim, eyes oddly bright.
A weak glue bound us, Orthheim. A few tears, and we part.
The dwarf's big feet rasped on the floor as he whirled completely around, stopped, facing Paul.
Ah, patron, I came the long way around to find you.
Paul nodded.
You'll be kind, Usul? Bijaz asked. I'm a person, you know. Persons come in many shapes and sizes, this be but one of them. I'm weak of muscle, but strong of mouth. Cheap to feed, but costly to fill. Empty me as you will, there's still more in me than men put there.
We've no time for your stupid riddles, Duri growled. You should be gone.
I'm riddled with conundrums, Bijaz said, but not all of them stupid. To be gone, Usul, is to be a bygone, yes? Let us let bygones be bygones. Duri speaks truth, and I've the talent for hearing that, too.
You've truth sense? Paul asked,
determined now to wait out the clockwork of his vision. Anything was better than shattering these moments and producing the new consequences. There remained things for Orthheim to say, lest time be diverted into even more horrifying channels.
I've now sense, Bijaz said.
Paul noted that the dwarf had grown more nervous. Was the little man aware of things about to happen? Could Bijaz be his own oracle?
Did you inquire of Lichna?
Orthheim asked suddenly, peering up at Duri with his one good eye.
Lichna is safe, Duri said.
Paul lowered his head lest his expression betray the lie.
Safe. Lichna was ashes in a secret grave.
That's good then,
Orthheim said, taking Paul's lowered head for a nod of agreement.
One good thing among the evils, Usul. I don't like the world we're making, you know that? It was better when we were alone in the desert with only the Harkonnens for enemy.
There's but a thin line between many an enemy and many a friend, Bijaz said. Where that line stops, there's no beginning and no end. Let's end it, my friends.
He moved to Paul's side, jittered from one foot to the other.
What's now sense? Paul asked,
dragging out these moments, goading the dwarf.
Now, Bijaz said, trembling. Now, now,
he tugged at Paul's robe.
Let us go now.
His mouth rattles, but there's no harm in him,
Orthheim said, affection in his voice, the one good eye staring at Bijaz.
Even a rattle can signal departure, Bijaz said, and so can tears. Let's be gone while there's time to begin.
Bijaz,
What do you fear? Paul asked. I fear the spirit seeking me now, Bijaz muttered.
Perspiration stood out on his forehead. His cheeks twitched.
I fear the one who thinks not and will have no body except mine, and that one gone back into itself. I fear the things I see and the things I do not see. This dwarf does possess the power of prescience, Paul thought.
Bijaz shared the terrifying oracle. Did he share the oracle's fate as well? How potent was the dwarf's power? Did he have the little prescience of those who dabbled in the Dune Tarot, or was it something greater? How much had he seen?
Best you go, Duri said. Bijaz is right.
Every minute we linger, Bijaz said, prolongs the present. Every minute I linger defers my guilt, Paul thought.
A worm's poisonous breath, its teeth dripping dust, had washed over him. It had happened long ago, but he inhaled the memory of it now, spice and bitterness. He could sense his own worm waiting, the urn of the desert.
These are troubled times, he said,
addressing himself to Othheim's judgment of their world.
Fremen know what to do in time of trouble, Duri said.
Othheim contributed a shaky nod. Paul glanced at Duri. He'd not expected gratitude, would have been burdened by it more than he could bear. But Othheim's bitterness and the passionate resentment he saw in Duri's eyes shook his resolve. Was anything worth this price?
Delay serves no purpose, Duri said. Do what you must, Usul,
Othheim wheezed. Paul sighed. The words of the vision had been spoken.
There'll be an accounting, he said, to complete it.
Turning, he strode from the room, heard Bijaz foot slapping behind.
Bygones, bygones, Bijaz muttered as they went. Let bygones fall where they may. This has been a dirty day.
The convoluted wording of legalisms grew up around the necessity to hide from ourselves the violence we intend toward each other. Between depriving a man of 1 hour from his life and depriving him of his life, there exists only a difference of degree. You have done violence to him, consumed his energy. Elaborate euphemisms may conceal your intent to kill, but behind any use of power over another, the ultimate assumption remains, I feed on your energy. Addenda to orders in council, the Emperor Paul Muad'Dib. First moon stood high over the city as Paul, his shield activated and shimmering around him, emerged from the cul-de-sac. A wind off the massif whirled sand and dust down the narrow street, causing Bijaz to blink and shield his eyes.
We must hurry, the dwarf muttered. Hurry, hurry. You sense danger? Paul asked, probing. I know danger.
An abrupt sense of peril very near was followed almost immediately by a figure joining them out of a doorway. Bijaz crouched and whimpered. It was only Stilgar, moving like a war machine, head thrust forward, feet striking the street solidly. Swiftly, Paul explained the value of the dwarf, handed Bijaz over to Stilgar. The pace of the vision moved here with great rapidity. Stilgar sped away with Bijaz. Security guards enveloped Paul. Orders were given to send men down the street toward the house beyond Othheim's. The men hurried to obey, shadows among shadows.
More sacrifices, Paul thought.
We want live prisoners,
one of the guard officers hissed. The sound was a vision echo in Paul's ears. It went with solid precision here, vision reality, tick for tick. Ornithopters drifted down across the moon. The night was full of Imperial troopers attacking. A soft hiss grew out of the other sounds, climbed to a roar while they still heard the sibilance. It picked up a terracotta glow that hid the stars, engulfed the moon. Paul, knowing that sound and glow from the earliest nightmare glimpses of his vision, felt an odd sense of fulfillment. It went the way it must.
Stone burner!
Someone screamed.
Stone burner!
The cry was all around him.
Stone burner! Stone burner!
Because it was required of him, Paul threw a protective arm across his face, dove for the low lip of a curb. It already was too late, of course. Where Othheim's house had been, there stood now a pillar of fire, a blinding jet roaring at the heavens. It gave off a dirty brilliance which threw into sharp relief every ballet movement of the fighting and fleeing men, the tipping retreat of ornithopters. For every member of this frantic throng, it was too late. The ground grew hot beneath Paul. He heard the sound of running stop. Men threw themselves down all around him, every one of them aware that there was no point in running. The first damage had been done, and now they must wait out the extent of the stone burner's potency. The thing's radiation, which no man could outrun, already had penetrated their flesh. The peculiar result of stone burner radiation already was at work in them. What else this weapon might do now lay in the planning of the men who had used it, the men who had defied the great convention to use it.
"Gods, a stone burner,"
someone whimpered.
"I don't want to be blind."
"Who does?"
the harsh voice of a trooper far down the street.
"That Lelaxu will sell many eyes here,"
someone near Paul growled.
"Now shut up and wait."
They waited. Paul remained silent, thinking what this weapon implied. Too much fuel in it, and it had cut its way into the planet's core. Dune's molten level lay deep, but the more dangerous for that. Such pressures released and out of control might split a planet, scattering lifeless bits and pieces through space.
"I think it's dying down a bit," someone said.
"It's just digging deeper," Paul cautioned. "Stay put, all of you. Stilgar will be sending help."
"Stilgar got away?"
"Stilgar got away." "The ground's hot," someone complained.
"They dared use atomics," a trooper near Paul protested. "The sound's diminishing," someone down the street said.
Paul ignored the words, concentrated on his fingertips against the street. He could feel the rolling, rumbling of the thing, deep, deep.
"My eyes," someone cried. "I can't see."
"Someone closer to it than I was," Paul thought.
He still could see to the end of the cul-de-sac when he lifted his head, although there was a mistiness across the scene. A red-yellow glow filled the area where Othheim's house and its neighbour had been. Pieces of adjoining buildings made dark patterns as they crumbled into the glowing pit. Paul climbed to his feet. He felt the stone burner die. Silence beneath him. His body was wet with perspiration against the still suit's slickness, too much for the suit to accommodate. The air he drew into his lungs carried the heat and sulphur stench of the burner. As he looked at the troopers beginning to stand up around him, the mist on Paul's eyes faded into darkness. He summoned up his oracular vision of these moments, then turned and strode along the track that time had carved for him, fitting himself into the vision so tightly that he could not escape. He felt himself grow aware of this place as a multitudinous possession, reality welded to prediction. Moans and groans of his troopers arose all around him as the men realized their blindness.
"Hold fast," Paul shouted. "Help is coming."
And as the complaints persisted, he said,
"This is Muad'Dib. I command you to hold fast. Help comes."
Silence. Then, true to his vision, a nearby guardsman said,
"Is it truly the Emperor? Which of you can see? Tell me."
"None of us has eyes," Paul said. "They have taken my eyes as well, but not my vision. I can see you standing there, a dirty wall within touching distance on your left. Now wait bravely. Stilgar comes with our friends."
The thwock-thwock of many thopters grew louder all around. There was the sound of hurrying feet. Paul watched his friends come, matching their sounds to his oracular vision.
"Stilgar!" Paul shouted, waving an arm. "Over here!"
"Thanks to Shai Hulud,"
Stilgar cried, running up to Paul.
"You're not..."
In the sudden silence, Paul's vision showed him Stilgar staring with an expression of agony at the ruined eyes of his friend and emperor.
Oh, my lord,
Stilgar groaned.
Usul, Usul, Usul.
What of the stone burner?
One of the newcomers shouted.
It's ended,
Paul said, raising his voice. He gestured. Get up there now and rescue the ones who were closest to it. Put up barriers, lively now. He turned back to Stilgar.
Do you see, my lord?
Stilgar asked, wonder in his tone.
How can you see?
For answer, Paul put a finger out to touch Stilgar's cheek above the still-suit mouth cap. Felt tears.
You need give no moisture to me, old friend, Paul said. I am not dead.
But your eyes?
They blinded my body, but not my vision, Paul said. Ah, still. I live in an apocalyptic dream. My steps fit into it so precisely that I fear most of all I will grow bored reliving the thing so exactly.
Usul, I don't. I don't.
Don't try to understand it. Accept it. I am in the world beyond this world here. For me, they are the same. I need no hand to guide me. I see every movement all around me. I see every expression of your face. I have no eyes. Yet I see.
Stilgar shook his head sharply.
Sire, we must conceal your affliction from...
We hide it from no man, Paul said.
But the law...
We live by the Atreides law now still. The Fremen law that the blind should be abandoned in the desert applies only to the blind. I am not blind. I live in the cycle of being where the war of good and evil has its arena. We are at a turning point in the succession of ages, and we have our parts to play.
In a sudden stillness, Paul heard one of the wounded being led past him.
It was terrible,
the man groaned.
A great fury of fire.
None of these men shall be taken into the desert, Paul said. You hear me still?
I hear you, my lord.
They are to be fitted with new eyes at my expense.
It will be done, my lord.
Paul, hearing the awe grow in Stilgar's voice, said,
I will be at the command, Thopter. Take charge here.
Yes, my lord.
Paul stepped around Stilgar, strode down the street. His vision told him every movement, every irregularity beneath his feet, every face he encountered. He gave orders as he moved, pointing to men of his personal entourage, calling out names, summoning to himself the ones who represented the intimate apparatus of government. He could feel the terror grow behind him, the fearful whispers.
His eyes! But he looked right at you, called you by name!
At the command thopter, he deactivated his personal shield, reached into the machine and took the microphone from the hand of a startled communications officer, issued a swift string of orders, thrust the microphone back into the officer's hand. Turning, Paul summoned a weapons specialist, one of the eager and brilliant new breed who remembered Siech life only dimly.
They used a stone burner, Paul said.
After the briefest pause, the man said,
So I was told, sire.
You know what that means, of course.
The fuel could only have been atomic.
Paul nodded, thinking of how this man's mind must be racing. Atomics. The Great Convention prohibited such weapons.
Discovery of the perpetrator would bring down the combined retributive assault of the great houses. Old feuds would be forgotten, discarded in the face of this threat and the ancient fears it aroused.
It cannot have been manufactured without leaving some traces, Paul said. You will assemble the proper equipment and search out the place where the stone burner was made.
At once, sire.
With one last fearful glance, the man sped away.
My lord,
the communications officer ventured from behind him.
Your eyes!
Paul turned, reached into the thopter, returned the command set to his personal band.
Call Cheney, he ordered. Tell her I am alive and will be with her soon.
Now the forces gather, Paul thought. And he noted how strong was the smell of fear in the perspiration all around.
He has gone from Alia, the womb of heaven, holy, holy, holy. Fire sand leagues confront our lord. He can see without eyes. A demon upon him, holy, holy, holy equation, he solved for martyrdom. The moon falls down. Songs of Muad'Dib. After 7 days of radiating fevered activity, the keep took on an unnatural quiet. On this morning there were people about, but they spoke in whispers, heads close together, and they walked softly. Some scurried with an oddly furtive gait. The sight of a guard detail coming in from the forecourt drew questioning looks and frowns at the noise which the newcomers brought with their tramping about and stacking of weapons. The newcomers caught the mood of the interior, though, and began moving in that furtive way. Talk of the stone burner still floated around.
He said the fire had blue-green in it, and a smell out of hell.
Elba is a fool. He says he'll commit suicide rather than take Tlelaxu eyes.
I don't like talk of eyes.
Muad'Dib passed me and called me by name.
How does he see without eyes?
People are leaving, had you heard? There's great fear. The Naives say they'll go to Sietch Makab for a grand council.
What have they done with the panegyrist?
I saw them take him into the chamber where the Naives are meeting. Imagine Korba, a prisoner.
Cheney had arisen early, awakened by a stillness in the keep. Awakening, she'd found Paul sitting beside her, his eyeless sockets aimed at some formless place beyond the far wall of their bedchamber. What the stone burner had done with its peculiar affinity for eye tissue, all that ruined flesh had been removed. Injections and unguents had saved the stronger flesh around the sockets, but she felt that the radiation had gone deeper. Ravenous hunger seized her as she sat up. She fed on the food kept by the bedside, spice bread, a heavy cheese. Paul gestured at the food.
Beloved, there was no way to spare you this. Believe me.
Cheney stilled a fit of trembling when he aimed those empty sockets at her. She'd given up asking him to explain. He spoke so oddly.
I was baptized in sand, and it cost me the knack of believing. Who trades in faiths anymore? Who'll buy? Who'll sell?
What could he mean by such words? He refused even to consider Tlelaxu eyes, although he bought them with a lavish hand for the men who'd shared his affliction. Hunger satisfied, Cheney slipped from bed, glanced back at Paul, noted his tiredness. Grim lines framed his mouth. The dark hair stood up, mussed from a sleep that hadn't healed. He appeared so saturnine and remote. The back and forth of waking and sleeping did nothing to change this. She forced herself to turn away, whispered,
"My love, my love."
He leaned over, pulled her back into the bed, kissed her cheeks.
"Soon we'll go back to our desert," he whispered. "Only a few things remain to be done here."
She trembled at the finality in his voice. He tightened his arms around her, murmured,
"Don't fear me, my Sihaya. Forget mystery and accept love. There's no mystery about love. It comes from life. Can't you feel that?"
"Yes."
She put a palm against his chest, counting his heartbeats. His love cried out to the Fremen spirit in her, torrential, outpouring, savage. A magnetic power enveloped her.
"I promised you a thing, beloved," he said. "A child of ours will rule such an empire that mine will fade in comparison. Such achievements of living and art and sublime."
"We're here now,"
she protested, fighting a dry sob.
"And I feel we have so little time."
"We have eternity, beloved."
"You may have eternity. I have only now."
"But this is eternity."
He stroked her forehead. She pressed against him, lips on his neck. The pressure agitated the life in her womb. She felt it stir. Paul felt it too. He put a hand on her abdomen, said,
"Ah, little ruler of the universe, wait your time. This moment is mine."
She wondered then why he always spoke of the life within her as singular. Hadn't the medics told him? She searched back in her own memory, curious that the subject had never arisen between them. Surely he must know she carried twins. She hesitated on the point of raising this question. He must know. He knew everything. He knew all the things that were herself. His hands, his mouth, all of him knew her. Presently she said,
"Yes, love, this is forever. This is real."
And she closed her eyes tightly, lest sight of his dark sockets stretch her soul from paradise to hell. No matter the Rihani magic in which he'd enciphered their lives, his flesh remained real, his caresses could not be denied. When they arose to dress for the day, she said,
"If the people only knew your love."
But his mood had changed. "You can't build politics on love," he said. "People aren't concerned with love. It's too disordered. They prefer despotism. Too much freedom breeds chaos. We can't have that, can we? And how do you make despotism lovable?"
"You're not a despot," she protested, tying her scarf. "Your laws are just."
"Ah, laws," he said. He crossed to the window, pulled back the draperies as though he could look out. "What's law? Control? Law filters chaos, and what drips through? Serenity? Law, our highest ideal and our basest nature. Don't look too closely at the law. Do, and you'll find the rationalized interpretations, the legal casuistry, the precedents of convenience. You'll find the serenity, which is just another word for death." Cheney's mouth drew into a tight line. She couldn't deny his wisdom and sagacity, but these moods frightened her. He turned upon himself and she sensed internal wars. It was as though he took the Fremen maxim, never to forgive, never to forget, and whipped his own flesh with it. She crossed to his side, stared past him at an angle. The growing heat of the day had begun pulling the north wind out of these protected latitudes. The wind painted a false sky full of ochre plumes and sheets of crystal, strange designs in rushing gold and red. High and cold, the wind broke against the shield wall with fountains of dust. Paul felt Cheney's warmth